And we're going to be looking specifically at the time period today from 1660 to 1713. And there's a reason for that. 1713 might seem like a little bit of an arbitrary date to pick, but the reason I'm picking it is related to when the next sort of major king's printer ascended to his position. If you're joining us online, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, you can scroll down right here under recent sermons, click on the link for lesson 246, and you should be able to follow along with us here as we work our way through the material. And there will be things that I want to show on the screen this morning and all that sort of stuff. So, let's get started. All right, again, lesson 246, assessing the printed history of the King James text. We're looking at the time period from 1660 to 1713. All right? So, introduction. In lesson 245, we concluded our survey of the printed history of the King James text through the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. In doing so, we identified four main forms of the text, each with its own unique readings and printer's errors to varying degrees. So we've seen that there was a text being printed at London, one at Cambridge, one at Edinburgh, and then one at Amsterdam. So there were four different forms of the text being published during that time period. Okay? Moreover, we outlined two different periods between 1611 and 1660 in terms of market structure that were influenced by politics. All right, and those are these two right here. So we've got the monopoly period, which I've put a date on of 1660 to 1642. And this is when the rights to the text were vested in the crown, and only crown-approved printers could print the text. And so this led to market manipulation on the part of the king's printer. We've seen that quite a bit as we've worked our way through this, okay? And then the second time period, I've called it the free market period, which is from 1642 to 1660, and this is during the English Civil War and Cromwellian Commonwealth, when the office of the king's printer lapsed, thereby allowing other parties to enter the market. This led to a kind of wildcat period. And again, I'm getting that terminology, wildcat period, from a period of history in American banking where there was like zero regulation on the banks and banks were sort of doing their own thing and it was all confusion as far as how things were being done. And I kind of see a similarity there between what was happening with the printing of the text during this period here. So this led to a kind of wildcat period where there was little control over the market and many gross errors of the press. So we've seen that already. Next point. For want of something better, it is largely believed that the 1638 Cambridge edition became the de facto standard between 1600 and 1660, excuse me, and when the text was next edited by Cambridge in 1762. According to Professor David Norton, by 1660, the impulse to, quote, fix the text was ascendant. Innovation was confined almost entirely to presentation and extra textual matters. So that's what we've seen, right? That as far as the work being done to the actual text, there was little outside of spelling and a few other things, okay? And there was a lot being done, though, as far as adding pictures and other metatextual information to kind of create niches in the market. We saw that last time. In this lesson, we will seek to survey the years between 1660 and 1713, when John Baskett became the dominant figure in Bible printing for the next half a century. So around 1713, John Baskett is going to become the king's printer. And he's going to basically dominate printing in England from right around 1713 up through 1750, 1760 in there, okay? So he's going to be the prominent figure of the first half of the 18th century as far as printing the Bible in England. So we're not quite to him yet. We'll get to him next time. So that brings us to our first main point, 100 years of solitude. And we're breaking this down so that the 100 years would stretch from 1660 to essentially 1762 when the text is published next. We're looking at the time period between 1660 and 1713 here in this particular lesson. We'll look at more of that time frame later on. Okay. So, bottom of page 1, 100 Years of Solitude. The title given to this period by Dr. Norton is meant to capture the reality that no large-scale editorial changes were made to the text of the King James Bible until 1762, when it was edited by Cambridge, edited at Cambridge by Francis Paris. Okay? While there were instances of sporadic and sparse spelling updates, they were not systematic or wide-reaching in scale and scope. So what Norton is calling this period from 1660 to 1762 is 100 years of solitude, meaning nothing's really being done outside of sporadic changes in spelling and some things here or there, which we'll see as we go through today's content. Okay? So, top page 2. Professor Norton discusses the impact of Kilburn's work and the resurrection of John Field's career at Cambridge in the years immediately following the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 in a textual history of the King James Bible. Please note that I have once again included screenshots of the various examples cited by Norton where it is possible to do so. So I've taken the Norton text and I've annotated it with pictures so that we can look at what he's talking about here. Okay? So, starting with this quote, Kilburn's campaign against poor printing and monopolies had some effect. By the time of the Restoration, Field, who had been the chief object of his criticism, so you remember, Field was one of the guys that printed one of the worst editions that Kilburn had criticized, right? We've been over that multiple different times. By this point, he was printer at Cambridge University. Okay, see bracketed insert below for more details on how this occurred. So we're going to come back to that in a minute. All right. And in the twilight of his career, produced editions that improved his reputation. So in this sort of second stage of his career, he improves his reputation by being much more accurate and thorough than he had been early on during that wildcat period that I just kind of went over there. Okay. However, they did almost nothing to the text. So that's the point, right? Field's best-known edition is his 1660 folio, H666 and H668. Those are the Herbert catalog numbers. But his minimal contribution to the text comes in his octavo of the same year, H669. There, Leviticus 25:5, of its own accord, first takes its modern form of its own accord. Okay, so here is where I do want to jump into a 1611, and I want to make some comparisons. Okay, so I've given you the screenshot there, and let's see, what do we need here? Leviticus 25, right? Leviticus 25, verse 5. And we can load this up. All right, so here's Leviticus 25. Verse 5 starts at the bottom of the page. Okay? That which groweth, now watch, of its own, come on, accord. So it says, of its own accord. Does that seem weird?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you look now at what Field is doing here in this particular one from 1660, notice the form. Notice the verse takes on this form. That which groweth of its own accord. Now, does that obviously seem to read better and make more sense than to say, like we see here, again, that which groweth of its own accord. Saying it's seems to make the sentence flow better, does it not? Okay, so we see a change here that's occurring in this edition by Field. So this is the first time that takes its modern form. So grab your Bible quick and look at Leviticus 25. Look at Leviticus 25 and verse 5. So I have in my Bible at verse 5, okay, that which groweth of its own accord. So my modern 1769 printing, does it match this change that was made here by Field in 1660? Before that, it was of its own accord instead of its own what? Accord, all right? So there's a change there, all right? Look at the next one in the notes. Among the modern spellings, that this text occasionally introduces are the consistent use of alien and floats for flouts. Okay, in 1 Kings 5:9. So look at the verse here. I've underlined it for you. Notice floats. F-L-O-A-T-S. Alright? Let's jump into the 1611 quick. And we want, what do we want here? 1 Kings 5:9. What's that?
5:9.
1 Kings 5:9. And we want to actually look at the text. And 1 Kings 5, look at verse 9. Here it is. That way down here at the bottom. Notice how this is spelled. Flouts. F-L-O-T-E-S. Okay? Now, what is a better way of spelling that word? The way that it is spelled in ours. Get 1 Kings 5:19 in your Bible. Or 1 Kings 5:9. So if I look in mine, 1 Kings 5:9, I look at the way that that's spelled. And let's see here, floats is F-L-O-A-T-S, right? So this reading or spelling is first coming in this particular 1661 that is being done by Field. And so he is making some changes to the spelling. Look at the next bit of your notes. As with hundreds of examples one might choose, this latter is an inconsistent change. Okay? So flouts remains at 2 Chronicles 2:16 and 1 Esdras 5:55. So in other words, do they consistently update the spelling all the way through? They do not. So you will still find it the old spelling in this 1660 intermixed. Okay? What is significant about it is that it suggests that this particular octavo, unlike most of the innumerable editions in smaller formats, did sometimes influence the text. Flouts was common until about 1960 and can still be found in some editions. Meaning, can you still find editions where their spelling here is inconsistent on this particular word? This is what Norton is saying, okay? The reason for this influence may be additions to the marginal notes, which Scribner takes to be the notable aspect of the edition. So let's just look at that quick. In your Bible, go to 2 Chronicles 2. Be curious to see. I actually haven't checked this yet. Go to 2 Chronicles chapter 2. And look at verse 16. 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 16. Okay, mine spells it. And we will cut wood out of Lebanon and make as much as thou shalt need, and we will bring it to thee in floats, F-L-O-A-T-S.
F-L-O-T-E-S.
What do you have?
O-T-E-S.
I have F-L-O-A-T-S.
I have F-L-O-T-E-S.
See? Some of you guys have corrupt Bibles. But who has it F L O A T S? Who has it F L O T E S? Bart's not looking, so we're not sure what he's got. Bart, what do you have? How do you have that word spelled in?
I've got a King James
Oxford. So I'm assuming yours is probably spelled the same way mine is. Okay, but this is what we're talking about, right? I mean, here we are sitting in the 21st century with the modern printing techniques, and some of us still have some of the words are spelled what? They're not spelled the same. Okay? So, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like some of the stuff that people say sometimes, this is where, to me, it gets a little superstitious. Because is anybody going to sit here and say that if your Bible doesn't spell it the way mine does, that you have a corrupt Bible because the word's spelled different? I'm not willing to say that. Other people are. They're actually willing to say that's a corruption, okay? Because it's not an exact match.
Do the two words mean the same back in the day?
Yeah. As far as I know, they do, yeah. They're just variant spellings of the same word.
That's what's weird about English, because quote Tote isn't T-O-A-T. Tote is T-O-T-E.
Well, that's the same thing with donut. How do you spell donut? D-O-N-U-T or D-O-U-G-H-N-T.
Yeah.
Donut. How do you, so...
All you gotta do is watch one of Gallagher's shows from years ago and he'll just point out all the stupidity of English.
And there's a lot of variety, yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, it's just inconsistent, no rhyme or reason to why it is the way it is.
I always thought it was because we had so many different languages making our country that
yeah,
we adopted words from other languages that we didn't always have.
Yeah.
So notice on page 2. Let me see here. Let me see if I can point it out so everyone can identify. I left. See this 37 mark footnote 37.
Yeah.
Okay. Go to the top page 3. Here you see a 37. So that corresponds to the other 37 in the text, okay? Let's look at this footnote 37. 1611 uses alien, alien, and alien. Okay? So it uses alien, A-L-I-E-N. It uses alien, A-L-I-E-N-T. And it uses alien, A-L-I-A-N-T. And the inconsistency goes back to changes made or not made in Bob 1602. That's his opinion. Before 1660, Before 1660, only two uses of the older forms had been modernized. Okay? So look at this one here. So again, here's what he's talking about. So here's Exodus 18:3. And notice how this particular edition from 1660 spells alien. It spells it A-L-I-E-N, right? So let's jump into the 1611. And what verse is that? Exodus
18:3.
Exodus 18:3. I'll leave it to Alex. Okay? Now, where'd it go? Alien. A-L-I-E-N. In the 1611. Okay? This 1660 has A-L-I-E-N. So, I sort of look at that and I say, okay, what's the point here? Okay? But you can see that there's all these different ways that even a word like that is going to be spelled. Look at the next one, footnote 38. So footnote 38 is related to this part right here about floats and flouts, 38. So page 3, footnote 38, it introduced, referring to the 1660 octavo, the following modernizations, some of which were ignored, only to be reintroduced at a later time. For as much as one word, for so much, three words. Okay? Then it says impossible with an I-M for impossible, U-N. Okay? Jailer, J-A-I-L-O-R, for jailer, J-A-Y-L-O-U-R, or jailer, J-A-Y-L-E-R, in the 1611, 1638, Acts 1623, loose, L-O-S-E, for less, lease, less, in 1 Kings 18:5, prized, for prized, P-R-I-S-E-D, in Zechariah 11:13, stank, for stunk in Exodus 7:21, and drank for drunk in Daniel 5:4. Okay? Now, I was able to give examples of all of these. Okay? So let's look at Isaiah 8 first. Isaiah 8:6, right? Now, this one to me is interesting because There's a lot of conversation right now on the internet and different places about numerology and numbers and counting things and all sorts of stuff like that, all right? Now, look at this verse right here, 16:11. For so much. How many words is that?
Three.
Okay? In the 1661 that we're looking at, that becomes how many words?
One
word. Okay? For as much. So if you go in your Bible, get Isaiah 8:6. I did look at this one already. Get Isaiah 8:6. I think it is. For as much, I believe, is a word. Isaiah 8:6. So in my Oxford 1769, I have for as much one word. So here's my point, okay? If you're now counting words in a Bible to make some sort of numerological point, how do you count this verse? How do you count this as one word, or do you count this as what?
Three words.
Because in the 1611, it was three what?
Three words.
And it was this way in 1611, and as far as I can tell, all the way through until 1660, when Field makes an update here where he spells it all as what?
One word.
So how do you count that now? Does that count as three? Does it count as one? Which is the right one to count? How do you know? What verse tells you? That's as good an explanation as anyone else can come up with. Okay? So, here's the other thing. If you look at this, for so much, for as much, different way of saying the same thing?
Yes.
But is this an editorial change?
Yes.
The editor made a change. They took what was three words and they made it what? One word. This is not the correction of a printer error. This is not a printer error. This is an editorial what?
Change.
Taking three words and putting it as what? One word. It doesn't alter the meaning, doesn't impact what the text says or means, but it's an editorial change. Mike?
It's the same as a spelling change, really, isn't it?
Right. But my point is, there is no obvious spelling mistake for so much. All the words aren't spelled right. It's just this is a modern preferred way of saying the same thing in one word that you said before in how many words?
Three words.
Okay? But again, you know, you start telling the truth about some of this stuff and some people lose their minds and think that you're saying stuff that, you know, isn't the case. Let's look at Matthew 17. Okay? Matthew 17:20. Notice, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Okay? Let's go look at the 16:11. Notice, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Impossible, impossible. Six of one, half a dozen of what?
The other.
Okay, does it impact the sense of the text at all? And I did check this one, but I'm pretty sure all of you have it, what, in your Bible? Some of you, I saw you looking. I have impossible in mine. Who has impossible? Everyone else says impossible? Okay. Acts 16, verse 23, we're looking at the spelling of jailer. J-A-I-L-O-R, jailer. Let's look at the 16:11. Acts 16, verse 23. Verse 23, look at jailer. Capital J-A-Y-L-O-U-R, jailer. Okay? Updated spelling. Substantive difference in meaning? No, same what? Same word, spelled what? Different.
That's how the English spell color in Harvard.
They spell a bunch of words with a U in it that we don't have.
O-U-R,
yeah. Labor, honor, all sorts of words they spell that way.
Is there a difference? Mine doesn't have a capital J. Otherwise it's spelled
different. That's because in the 1611 they basically capitalized anything that they thought was like a proper title. Okay, and that's a convention that fell out later on. Okay, that they stopped doing that. All right, let's 1 Kings 18:5. Okay, so notice what it says. So that we loose not all the beasts. Is that what that says? Huh? So we want 1 Kings 18. What verse is it again?
18:5.
All right, 1 Kings 18:5. All right, right here. Now notice. How is this spelled? Lease. L-E-E-S what? E. Versus what?
Loose.
Loose. L-O-S what?
Loose. Two
O's
is loose. One O.
Loose. What did I say?
Loose.
Sorry, I meant loose. What is it?
English.
Like you don't want to lose your wallet kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Let's see. Go to 1 Kings.
You want to lose your wallet?
I don't know. I don't know if I want to lease it or loose it or lose it. I probably none of the above, right?
Lose it.
1 Kings 18 and verse 5. What do we have? Somebody's already there can look, right? L-O-S-E, right?
Yeah.
All right, so there's again, an update in the spelling that's occurring, all right? In your notes, go to page 4. We got prized, P-R-I-Z-E-D, Zechariah 11:3. Let's look in the 1611. All right, 11:3. Got the right 11:13. Whoops. Verse 13. Well, here it is. I found it. Prized, P-R-I-S-E-D, instead of what? P-R-I-Z-E-D. Now, I know some of you have already found it in your Bible. How's it spelled in your 1769?
I have an S.
S.
S. S. You have an S? So, yours is spelled more like this one then, hey? Where'd it go? P-R-I-S-E-D.
Yep.
Versus P-R-I-Z-E-D. Okay. The next one is Exodus 7, verse 21, with stank versus stunk. Okay. Is there a big difference between stank versus stunk? I don't really think so. Having been in a class full of smelly teenagers, I think there's the same thing as stank and stunk. I just don't think there's too much of a difference there. And then the same thing would be with Daniel 5:4, which would be drank versus what? Drunk. Okay? That's Daniel 5:4. That's the last one on the list. They drank wine versus they drunk wine. Okay? In my mind, that's 6 of 1, half a dozen of another, right? 1611 had drunk.
Is there a difference between tenses? Drank drunk and stank stunk?
I mean, you might argue, based upon proper English, maybe there's a difference. But in the context, I don't think it matters to what the verse is saying. So let's go just check on Daniel 5:4 quick. You know, if you want to be like that English teacher that corrects everybody all the time, there you might have a...
I think you stank before you stunk.
So
drank,
here's
you drank before you were
1611,
drunk.
They drunk wine. Okay? So drunk wine was D-R-U-N-K-E, and then that becomes drank, D-R-A, it's kind of hard to read, N-K. And I believe that the 1769 also has drank, right?
Drink.
Not drunk.
Yeah.
There. Amy's got drink. Drank. Who else has drank?
Drank.
Drank. Okay. So, what's the point of this little exercise? I think, for me, it just is showing that not a lot is being done to the text, but it does raise issues in my mind, especially this first one. In Isaiah 8:6, here you don't have a substantive change, but do you have a taking of what was originally 3 words and now making them 1 word? So if you're going to get involved in all this counting of words and all this sort of stuff that people seem to like to do, how are you going to count this verse? How are you going to count this word, and what does it do to your word counts? And that's my other kind of issue here is this. It doesn't work in every edition. So if it doesn't work in every edition, what are you proving now? I don't get it. I don't understand how this is now some sort of really important spiritual proof that the King James is perfect if you can't do the math in every edition of the King James. Now it seems to me what you're saying by implication is that, well, then there are some that are more perfect than others, which means there's something slightly inferior about the ones that are not as perfect as the one that you understand what I'm saying? Like, it seems to me there's implications for these things. Okay. Now, anybody have any questions or comments before we move on?
This guy took it all upon himself just to amend things as he saw fit.
Yeah, this is Field in 1660 changing the spellings of these words. Yeah. And that's kind of the point. Even on some of these, he changes them, and then what was the one we saw? Prized, right? He spelled it with a Z. That's not even the way we spell it now. It was the way we spell it now is the way the 1611 originally had it was.
Some of the changes he made, so then come 1762, they kept his changes.
Some of them, yeah.
And then some of them they didn't.
Right.
Because
they changed them back. And I would also say, and I think this is one of Norton's points, is that he makes these changes in the 1660, but that doesn't mean every other Bible that was published after 1660 until 1762 necessarily made all these spelling changes. Okay? So I would surmise heavily that you could find Bibles in the 1660s that in Isaiah 8:6, some of them spelled it for as much, and some of them had it the old way for so much. In the same decade, you've got one doing it this way, you've got another one doing it that way. Okay? So again, if you're gonna... I don't understand the argument, therefore, that says, well, all of the only differences between these editions are the correction of printer errors, punctuation, and updates in spelling. Okay? There's no editorial changes going on. That is not true. Okay? To take 3 words and now make them 1 word, to me, is an editorial change. It's related to spelling, but it's an editor saying this word should be spelled this way instead of that way, instead of 3 words that way. Okay? Alright, so, are there any questions before we move on? If not, we're on the bottom of page 4. Next, Norton talks about the changes that were made to the marginalia of the AV between 1660 and 1762. Quote, The marginal notes and references were further developed under, and I don't know this word, Aegis of Field's successor as Cambridge printer John Hayes in 1670 and 1678. Development of the marginal material was a sensible commercial move. James's aversion to the Geneva notes had been influenced in making the King James Bible a version free of explanatory annotations, but that was, and still is, a strong popular desire for such notes. From 1642 on, at least 9 editions of the King James Bible were published with the Geneva annotations. We've already seen that, right? And Henry Hammond's popular A Paraphrase and Annotations Upon All the Books of the New Testament, H640, which gave the King James Bible text a paraphrase and annotations, first appeared in 1653. So go to the next page. So I've got screenshots of this. So here's the title page, okay? A Paraphrase and Annotations Upon All the Books of the New Testament, Explaining the Difficult Places Thereof. And this is from London, and this dates from, what was the date on this one again? 1653, okay? And then I've also included screenshots for you of like what these pages look like. So let's see if I can zoom in a little bit more. So here's the text. This is math. This is a page from Matthew. So you guys see these numbers here. This is going to be the King James text. But then all the rest of this stuff is marginalia, explanation. And then at the bottom of the page, you have annotations upon chapter 1, where it gives extensive annotations that covers basically 2 pages. Okay? So here's what is the end of Matthew chapter 1. And then it gives you the rest of that page and all of the next page as annotation. Okay? And then if you go to the next page, you'll see that it continues on to the next page before it starts chapter 2 at the top over here. So you've got 2.5 pages of paraphrase and annotation on Matthew chapter 1 in this particular Bible until you get to Matthew chapter 2 where the text starts again. And then you got the King James text. Notice you got bracketed stuff in here, paraphrasing, all sorts of stuff going on as far as trying to offer helps and explanations to the reader. And this is happening in 1653. So that's quite extensive, I would say. Okay, page 6. When John Fell at Oxford first considered printing a King James Bible at Oxford, he envisioned an annotated edition, but this never materialized. Okay, and then there's a footnote in there about Scribner about a 1677 edition, H736. But Herbert does not but this particular one that I got the screenshots on is quite extensive in its annotation, and that's a New Testament, right? So that's an example again of a publisher, and what are they trying to capitalize on in the market? They're trying to capitalize on the desire for the text to have what?
Notes
and extra explanatory information. And you can see that this Bible is quite extensive in what it was providing. Now, I haven't taken any time to like study the doctrine or the theology of these notes. In the latter half of the 17th century, Cambridge disappeared as a printer and publisher of Bibles. Around the same time, Oxford emerged as a publisher of the text. Quote, Cambridge declined and then disappeared as a printer and publisher of Bibles in its last edition. For more than half a century, appearing in 1683, London, Scotland, and Holland continued strong, and Oxford began its rise with quartos in 1675 and 1679. So it's an interesting phenomenon that around the time Cambridge sort of stops printing Bibles, who's going to start emerging now at the latter half of this century now is going to start printing Bibles, okay? The story of Oxford's entrance into the Bible market during this period is important to note. Quote, in 1632, Archbishop Laud had obtained from Charles I papers patent given Oxford University similar printing rights to those enjoyed at Cambridge, And for 40 years, there was a succession of agreements whereby, for a consideration, Oxford forbore to exercise its right to print Bibles. So remember, we talked about that in the last lesson, right? That they were being paid £80 a year to not what? To not print the Bible. Top page 7. In 1648, John Field, who was the dominant figure in Bible print for 20 years, issued his first Bible. Bribery, strong-arm tactics, such as sending soldiers to seize Bentley's work on a New Testament in 1656 and his election in 1655 as the printer to the University of Cambridge, all entrenched his power. Now watch. With the Restoration, Bill and Barker's heirs returned as King's printers, but Field and Hills bought off the competition from Oxford for £80 a year. And Field remained the dominant figure in spite of his deservedly low reputation of his previous work. So we've already seen that point in last week's lesson, right? So Oxford is being bought off to the rate of £80 a year for a time for them to forego their right to publish the text. Okay? That's going to change later on. Unlike the first Cambridge King James Bible, the first Oxford, 1675, H719 and 720, did little to the text other than employing idiosyncratic spelling, which aroused some complaint. The new publisher thus failed to stake out new ground and was put in his place by a simple, expedient, and underselling as Cambridge had been earlier. Okay? Now we can see these title pages. So here's the title page from the first Oxford. So you've got this image here, okay, this artwork, and then here's the title page. The Holy Bible containing the Old Testament and the New translated out of the original tongues, and with former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special command appointed to run the churches. And then you can see down here, Oxford at the theater, 1675. So that's the first Oxford printed. Okay. Further supplementary material was introduced in the second Oxford edition, 1679, H744 through 746, notably the dates, which long remained a fixture in the King James Bible and can still be found in some editions, where they are given as years after creation, the Nativity being dated 4000. Okay? So look at the next page. So here's the Gospel of Matthew. Okay? Look at chapter 1, verse 28. Verse 25, excuse me. And he knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name what? Jesus. Now, I've noticed this red. It's got the year what? 4,000 in the margin. So they're saying that this is 4,000 years after who? Adam. Okay? That's what they're intending to say here. So this is where we see these dates now being added to the text as an ancillary addition for the dating of biblical events from the time of Adam. Okay? So the basis underneath that, the basis for the dates was Archbishop James Usher's calculations in Annals Veritas to Novi Testamenti, 1650 to 54. Okay? And they took their familiar form, BC 4004, from the creation, etc., and in the 1701 folio printed by Bill and
Executive.
How do you say it?
Executrix
of Newcomb, London, H868. So here we see this for the one of the first times, this 4,000 being ascribed to the date of Christ's what? Birth. Okay. How much time we got left? Okay. Professor Norton elaborates on these early Oxford Bibles in his other book, The King James Bible Short History from Tyndale to Today. John Fell, Bishop of Oxford, Vice Chancellor of the University, and the driving force behind what became Oxford University Press, had proposed that Oxford should produce a new annotated edition that might have, quote, advantages beyond any other design that we can think of. But his scheme probably failed because it was impractical. Consequently, the early Oxford Bibles offered little that was distinctive. Besides the reintroduction of dates in the 1679 edition, given as numbers, which is what we just talked about, in the margins beginning from zero, there were slightly odd spellings. Sometimes the 1675 edition uses 1611 spellings that had become generally discussed in Bibles. These produced complaints, such as this from Humphrey Prideaux. Yeah?
Prideaux.
Quote, "I must confess, since Mr. Dean," it's referring to Dean Fell, "hath taken the liberty of inventing a new way of spelling and using it therein, which I think will confound and alter the analogy of English of the English tongue, that I do not at all approve of." So, can you make anybody happy with the way you're spelling these words? You can't make anybody happy with the way they're spelling these words, okay? These innovations were unsuccessful. Most were removed in the 1679 edition. In the same work, Dr. Norton also touches upon the Bible market of the late 17th century. Quote, "A significant development happened at this time. The 1679 edition was printed for four London booksellers who had been involved in importing cheaper and often better printed Bibles from Holland. The stationer's company, and with it the king's printer, had become more effective in blocking the often better printed Bibles from Holland, seriously affecting the businesses of four London booksellers. The most famous of them, Thomas Guy, founder of Guy's Hospital in London, and a dissenter by background, was particularly keen to go on selling Bibles, so he and three contracted with Oxford in 1678 to create what became the Oxford Bible Press, an entity long distinct from the academic press at Oxford, and especially in the 19th century, both larger and more profitable. Initially, its word was to produce large numbers of cheap Bibles, thereby arousing years of costly legal opposition, underselling, and disputation from the king's printers. From the king's printers. Such competition and increase in supply led to a substantial fall in the price of Bibles. So now we're seeing the opposite happening, where the competition is driving down the price. Okay? Such competition and increase in supply led to a substantial fall in the price of Bibles. In a memorandum written 1684, Fell noted that folios had fallen from £6 to £1.10, and that the smallest formats were now sold at 1 shilling 4 denarius. Bulk purchase for charity contributed to this fall. So now we see competition driving down the price of what? Bibles, versus when they had the monopolistic power, they were driving up the price of Bibles. Okay, 1701 saw the publication of a new folio edition by Bill and
Executrix
of Newcombe, London, H868. Professor Norton states the following regarding this edition in A Textual History of the King James Bible. Quote, "This edition, or perhaps the Oxford folio of the same year, H867, was prepared by Bishop William Lloyd at the request of the convocation in 1699 for an improved edition. It is not clear whether there was serious dissatisfaction with the state of the text as it happened. Neither this nor the Oxford folio made much in the way of significant changes, and Scrivener notes that, quote, except in regard to the dates, no principal edition so little influenced succeeding Bibles as this, notwithstanding the high auspices under which it came forth. Rather than scholarly attention to the originals, both of these 1701 folios show a little concern with the spelling of names and with correctness and modernness of English. The London edition, which has slightly more innovations, changes the archaic and other tempting him to the modern and others, I'm assuming, tempting him. Luke 11:16, but nowhere else. For so much, so we've already seen this one, right? Becomes for as much in 1 Maccabees 14. And in London only, Isaiah 8:6. We already talked about that one being messed with. And in London only, impossible for impossible gives you the references. More drastically, for the change is arguably a change of word and meaning. Both editions alter shame fast and shame fastness to shame faced and shame facedness. Okay? And that's in Ecclesiasticus 26:15. It gives you the references. Okay? The same change can be made, the same change had been made in 1674 in 1 Timothy 2:9. And they correct the seemingly faulty English grammar of "the riches that he hath gotten is perished" to "are perished" in Jeremiah 40:36. They also give the modern form "his wives' sons," right? His wife's sons. That's the way I would read that.
Or his wives. It changes from F to B.
Wives.
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 The wives.
Yes. With a V.
Yeah.
Wife's wives.
Yes.
Okay. That's Judges 11:2. Okay. Then you can see there in the footnotes, they mention a couple different changes in spellings. Both editions, Chaldees for Chaldees. 2 Kings 25. Continuing the regularization of spelling.
Hananiel
for Hananiel, I guess. Yes?
Yeah.
Reversing the Bod 1602 change. Jeremy with a Y at the end for Jeremy with an IE at the end. Zachary with a Y at the end for Zachary with an IE at the end. Judith for Judith throughout Judith. and so forth. So all these are different changes that are happening to the spelling in these different editions. Okay. And then in footnote 44 there, and four other minor changes in both editions, hosts. And he dwelt for hosts, and he dwelt for hosts and dwelt. That's an interesting one. 1 Maccabees 13, in London only, and of the fire for of fire. So there's a word added there. The word "the" is added. Okay. Let's look at that one. It's Deuteronomy 9, right?
Yeah.
Let's look at that one quick. Deuteronomy 9, what's the verse?
10.
Okay. Two tables of stone which were written in the figure of God, and on them was written according to the words which the Lord had spake with you in the mount out of the midst of the fire. Out of the midst of what?
The fire.
Well, here it says out of the midst of what?
Fire.
Yours adds the word what?
The.
Okay? So the 1611 says out of the midst of fire. Versus out of the midst of the what?
The fire.
the fire. Okay? So let me ask you again. Is there anything obvious here that would suggest that having or not having the word the is a printer error?
No.
So did somebody later on decide that the word the should be added to that verse to make it read better?
Yes.
So what did they do?
They put it in.
So again, if you're counting words, what are you going to do? Okay, you got a problem, right? So let's look at the conclusion here so we can be done reasonably on time. At the dawn of the 19th century, the King James text was in the state left by the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition. John Field and others made some updates in terms of spelling, but not all of these changes were adopted in the later printings with any uniformity. In the next lesson, we will look at the dominant figure in Bible printing during the 18th century, which is John Basket. Okay? Any comments or questions about what we've covered here? Are there any questions or comments in the chat?
No. See, English is such, because I mean, a non-English speaker, let's say somebody came over from Bulgaria and they're learning English, and they're going to go, why? Why? You know, why is this looked and pronounced, I mean, all of the way that it's just...
English is a weird language.
And we take it all for granted because, you know, when you grow up and that's all you've ever known. But when somebody comes and they're new to it, they're just going to go, this is stupid.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you start looking at some of this stuff, and again, I really feel, and obviously there are people out there in the ether that don't agree with me about this, but... There's no way you can convince me that there weren't editorial changes being made to these texts as they worked their way through history, where editors were impacting the way the text reads. And it's not all printer errors, it's not all punctuation, and it's not all the correction of spelling. There are other things going on that in ways the text is being impacted as you work your way through time. So to adopt what has been the standard King James only talking points on these things seems to me it does you no good, because it doesn't deal with the facts on the ground as they actually are. So, any other comments or questions?
I have a comment of like where you have the Bible and then you have the annotations and that. Now the Bible part could be correct, and then whoever's deciphering it, you know, what they think it says. I mean, that could turn somebody down the wrong path.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I have a Scofield Reference Bible just because I grew up on it, but I barely pay any attention anymore to what he says in his footnotes and in his center column references. When I was 13, just learning how to read and study a Bible, I thought, you know, I paid a lot of attention to what the, you know, metatextual stuff said, because I thought it was important. And then you get older, you get a little bit more wiser, a little bit more mature, and before you know it, like, you're not even paying attention to it anymore. Even though it's right there for you to... Some of it's helpful. Some of it I'm like, eh, no.
Because I've got a MacArthur study Bible at home.
Mm-hmm.
And
Lordship then, Salvation Bible.
Yeah, and then by looking at, and like you say, there's more annotation than there is Bible. And once I started to come to church here and knowing the truth, and then reading his, and I go, well, this is all Calvinism.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's just right there.
And that was the same thing with a lot of stuff in the Geneva Bible. Bart, did you have something?
Yeah. During this time period, was there any changes in printing presses that would have made a emphasis for economies of scale to be introduced that were too expensive for some of the older printers to...
I mean, that's a great question. My
I'm just wondering.
The short answer, I think, is no.
To get rid of the competition so they could produce...
I don't think there was any major technological advancements as far as the action of printing. I think one of the major ones that came was when they got into what they called stereotyping, where they would take plaster casts of type, and they would, and so then they would have these full pages in plaster casts that they could use to print from instead of having to reset type every time they wanted to print something. But that didn't happen until, like, as far as I know, until like the 1800s. So we're still over 100 years away from that type of a thing. And in America, one of the first guys to print the King James Bible in America, he had a warehouse where he had trays of standing type. Just trays after trays stacked up of standing type for printing the Bible. Because he viewed that as more efficient than having to redo it every time he wanted to print the Bible. So, anyway, any other questions or comments? All right.